the OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
We've got Ronan O'Gara with us. Ronan, good morning to you. How are you getting on?
Hi, Jar. I'm great. And yourself?
I'm good, thanks. We had James Collin there talking about that game against the All Blacks. He said that you said it was one of the best events you'd ever been at. Why did you guys not play in that game? What was the story with that?
Because we were playing, Ireland were playing on the Saturday, if I recollect correctly, or is that...
Yeah, no, that, like...
It wasn't a trick question, was it, Jared?
No. It's just like, is there no... is there a conversation?
No, we were in camp on the... That Tuesday, wasn't it? I think we were in camp on Tuesday. Was that a Tuesday or a Wednesday night kickoff, the All Blacks game?
I'll tell you exactly now. They said it was Wednesday when they were chatting there.
Yeah.
So...
It would have been, I think, and didn't Ireland play the New Zealand the following Saturday?
So you can't play twice in a week. That was a fairly straightforward. The frontline players
well,
play.
The way I played, it would have been better to play on the Wednesday night in Thomond Park, because I think it was a little bit of a warning sign for New Zealand and the fact, well, I think this is what an emotional Irish performance can do, but unfortunately we were well off when we played in green the following weekend. But that game in Thorn Park, just I suppose when you're a player too, it's different when you know you're finished, but when you're going to the ground as a player, I remember it really well. We parked in my Ross behind the ground and just to walk to the ground and very funny story. It was my first time in the heart of my Ross and Earlsey was obviously with me. I think we parked the car, myself, Dave Wallace and Keith Earls in probably Earlsey's folks house. And we were kind of walking to the ground, and Earlsey was kind of there, just keep your head down and keep going. And it was fine. But then we met one or two of the younger boys there, and one or two recognized me and they kind of go, geez, one of the best kickers in the world is in my Ross tonight. And they told their friends, and it was just like, it was brilliant just to see the joy of it, and they just couldn't believe that this guy who was a kicker of a rugby ball was in their park tonight. You know, it was brilliant. And then you just got chatting to them and just how nice the young kids were. And then they were kind of saying, come on, bring us to the game. But sure, we couldn't bring them into the game. We didn't have tickets for them, but like, they just didn't understand it. But it was a great moment. And I think that probably was just set the tone in terms of, I think the people didn't know what to expect, really, and obviously with the history of Munster and the All Blacks. But you could hear in Irish camp the vibes coming out of the Munster camp that something special was going to happen. Something special happened obviously before the game, but something special, as we know from hindsight, happened on the pitch as well. And I think it was anyone who knows Rua Tupoki and his Maori values and Dougie and what he stands for. And I think we had Jeremy Manning with Lafimi Mafi, so there's kind of elder statesmen and junior statesmen. So it was, they really had the rest of the Munster team kind of on tune with the culture and the tradition of what happens with receiving New Zealand teams. So it was just watching it from the stand, I just think it was probably a little bit, I wouldn't say subdued, but the moment the haka, I suppose, the Munster New Zealand boys did the haka, it just, I think, took any sporting event I was at to a whole new level, because you were kind of saying, it's not going to really work with four, is it? But it did work, and it worked incredibly well. And then it was game on, as Jor Canning would say, game on, you know. So it was a fantastic spectacle, I suppose, just to kind of go to see it. But you were kind of, as a player, you were measuring up, and you just were like, oh God, I wish I was out there, because it's your club, Munster, and it's so special. But it was so good for guys that didn't have the biggest day on European Cup finals. This was what you'd like to think that they hang around for and they don't go to other provinces for.
We don't know Rua. He didn't really do that many sit-down media interviews. So what? Like, you obviously really liked him, and I'm fairly sure you named one of your kids after him. Is that right?
Yeah, it would be. I like the name, but I suppose I like the man behind him too and what he stood for. And he was, maybe at the stage of the career I was, as a man, I really, really respected him and liked him, and he made the game very, very easy for me. I think you've heard this 100 times from me, Gerard, maybe some of the listeners haven't, but like in terms of playing the game, at that stage, I had, Dougie Howard on my right wing, so on my right-hand side, and I'd have, obviously, my 12, which was Tapoki, on my left-hand side. One of the good things I'd like to think of was probably I was able to see things, but when you have kind of three guys seeing the same things and being able to communicate on the run, it was just so enjoyable to play. I can particularly remember one of the early games, was it in the Rico Arena, where we played Wasps. And I don't think we'd probably had many games together, but we just really hit it off as a combination. And then if Rua said jump, Lafimi would say how high. Literally, it was like big brother, small brother, and the two of them were a brilliant combination together. And then Dougie was in charge of everything on the right-hand side, which a lot of people probably wouldn't think of rugby like that. Rugby league would be more familiar with that, about left and right side attacks. But in rugby union, you have it really as well, but we don't really use that language.
Right. And as a man, what was it that stood out? Because, again, I know nothing about him.
I suppose the fact that there's a great feeling on the pitch that someone has your back and will do whatever. I think I'm potentially had to earn that as well, you know, but when you earn that respect, you have to kind of talk yourself up, which isn't great. But I can remember we went to Claremont and we got a bonus point out of it, a losing bonus point, but maybe set us up for that campaign where I got split and I actually ended up getting 28 stitches in my right ear after the game, but kind of... it was a complete accident. One of the flankers jumped over the rock and he landed on my ear, and my ear just kind of exploded and it was flopping down. So I obviously had to go. But so Rua presumed that's me done for the day. And then he kind of says, he just broke out laughing. He goes, "What are you coming back on for?" And it was normal, you know, at that stage with adrenaline and stuff, you just kind of, whatever it takes. I don't know, would it be passed medically nowadays or anything like that, but there was different rules at that time and you come on with a head bandage. But it was, I think he probably associated me with a little bit of a pretty boy and hopefully not that tough. But I think that's when our relationship really crystallized, and I ended up getting a penalty late in the game. So it was kind of, it was moments like that that I think that people never hear about that are very, very important, because I was down in New Zealand for obviously 2 seasons and I met him regularly, and it's like I've never been apart from, which I think is testament to a relationship. But that was created in a really good environment in Munster. If you ask all the other boys, he'd be very, very popular too.
Yeah, it's a great humble brag. He told me he was a pretty boy. He just slipped that one in there, and the rest of us are like, oh, okay, right, that's that. I like what you did there, Ronan.
No. But in terms of, I suppose it was, you know what I mean? There was obviously, I put my body on the line at times. Tackle technique can be questioned, but you don't run out the gate, especially not in Claremont when there's 16,000 baying for you and you just can't roll over. But they're coming at you and they're coming at you, and you just got to stand there and do the best you can. That was... they were great days.
Ronan, can I just ask about those very early days, actually, with Munster? Because it just something that stuck out to me when you were talking about walking through Moy Ross before that game with Keith Earls was there ever a sense at the start of your Munster career about being a lad from Cork and the reception you got in Limerick, or perhaps even the Limerick lads during the games in Cork? Was there ever a getting to know period when it came to the fans that you almost had to build up an appreciation on their end of things for the Cork lad representing what I'd imagine a lot of Limerick people would imagine was a Limerick team?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, it is. And I think the most important thing to me too is I think the Limerick people took me as one of their own, and that doesn't happen very often, and that's the truth. But I think hopefully on European Cup nights in Thomond Park, I earned that right, I think, through performances on the pitch, because there for me, the Limerick, Joe Soap has their finger on the pulse big time, in terms of how they analyse and how they, I think, judge the rugby player. So I had to earn that, and I was, you know what I mean, a fancy Dan from Cork and going up to play there. And, you know what I mean, there's the infamous story of getting chased out of Tom Clifford Park by Young Munster. I ran away from Desi Clossy after I stamped on the other prop's head in a game, which was, I don't know what happened, but wow.
Hang on a second.
To do.
How famous is that we don't know it? Just to give us the pot
it's
of history.
It's very famous. It's very famous in Munster rugby circles. I got chased around the pitch by Des Clossy, and all the Thomond Park, or all Young Munster, 10,000 people were there. Open the gate, O'Gara's coming. Because I just, like, there was no way I was standing up to him you know what I mean? He was going to box the head off me. So I said to Desi, because I became very friendly with him in Munster camps, and still to this day, over the years, I said, did you think I was going to stand there toe-to-toe with you? I said, no, I was going to use my evasive skills and just try and get away from you. But there was definitely, I suppose, periods where Cork players would have been judged a little bit harsher on, coming back to your question. But I think in my case, I was competing with Killian Keane and Barry Everett before that. But Killian Keane, I think, was very good for me in the fact that he was from Dublin, or he's from Dublin, but he was playing with Gary Owen and residing in Limerick. And he made the transition, I suppose, easy for me. And things like what he says in the local paper is important too, I think, for young guys to kind of go, well, I'm here to help the squad. It's not like, oh, well, he's got a lot of weaknesses in his game and this is, you know, this should be my position. He was completely the opposite. He was very supportive and very, I suppose, understanding of the situation, that hopefully I'd have a longer time in an Irish jersey than he would. I think it was a big challenge, and it's a thing now that I'm finished that was very important to me, that you got to earn the respect the hard way and the right way, and that for me was very, very important, because obviously I'm very proud of being from Cork, but playing for Munster, it's very important that that you're respected on Limerick territory. You've got to earn that respect. That was key.
So would someone like Paul O'Connell have had an easier ride early doors wearing the red of Munster?
No, I don't think so. I think Paul was very much easy to pick out from the pack at a very young age. But then other people, kind of when they came down to Cork, a lot of them enjoy playing in Musgrave Park and the change up there. But for me, the place, you know, I mean, European nights and in January and December, it's Thomond Park, and it's a very, very, very special ground that I wouldn't ever like to dilute.
One of the things that we're all very interested in what's going to happen next is kind of the state of the game. And we've got a new weekly feature with Keith Woods, State of the Union, where we're talking to people around the world to see exactly what they think is going to happen next. And everything, it seems, is on the table at the moment, because we don't know when international rugby is going to be possible again. We don't know if tours are going to happen the way they used to happen. It's going to be interesting to see if fans are allowed into stadiums at some point in the next 18 months. Who knows what the lie of the land is going to be. So there is an opportunity for rugby to hit the reset button if they wanted to, and what that might look like.
Yeah. And we probably would need minimum 3 hours to even kind of scratch the surface. But as you said, Jared, now is the only time, because once we get back to playing and playing with people in the ground, it's too late because the machine is rolling. There's, as you said, there's a pause now. So this is the greatest time for growing the game or restructuring the game or doing whatever is possible to make the game better and more attractive to especially gather, I suppose, or try and choose a new market of people to get watching rugby. It has to grow because finances have all of a sudden become important, but also it is a time for asking the hard questions. But to do that, who's around the table doing this, or what strategic groups have they organized, or is it just country by country battling away? And for me, that doesn't seem to be the best policy to get stuff done.
It definitely feels like the sport needs to decide what the shared vision of the future looks like. And for me, I kind of feel like the player's voice needs to be elevated a little bit in this. Like, there should be a rough number of games that you would expect a front line player, a top tier elite player to play every year. If you look at the NFL, for example, they play 16 regular season games. Next season, it's going to be 17. And they play two or three preseason, and then you keep going week by week as long as you last. And everybody knows that's the absolute maximum number of games that you're going to be allowed to play. Like, what is the number of games that a rugby player should play? And then work back from that.
Well, exactly. But I think even before that, it's kind of, you've got to ask the question, who owns the players? So in Ireland, the federation or the union own the players, but in France, the club owns the players. So already you have an instant loggerhead situation where the French Federation don't control their players. They control it in windows. But I think the Premiership and the top 14, if I'm correct, the English players are contracted to their clubs, and then some of them have special deals with the RFU. But in France, players are contracted to their club. The wages of the French national team are paid by the clubs, and they're obviously increased in performance bonuses when they do represent France. But it's a very different model in terms of, I suppose, what we're used to in Ireland. And you can see already now, I think I was reading this morning, that there's potential boycott of the European Cup because of, I think, how many French clubs are going to be in it. And the French and the English team seem to be very united in their vision. But if you are to play a top 14 season without playoffs, you have 26 league games. You know, so they're like, as you say, there's an awful lot of digging through here to get what is actually the best formula for having an attractive calendar that suits everyone. I think also, you know, it doesn't make sense for me, the fact that in June or after European Cup final, a lot of Irish players go to the Southern Hemisphere in the depths of winter. And then Southern Hemisphire comes to, I know we've been spoiled with the weather the last probably year or two in the end of November to play the big games. But if you were to reverse them straight away, I think it would be a far more attractive game, and you're not looking for extra windows. But the problem nowadays is you've 52 weeks in the year, you've probably 40 of them are viable, because with the players' unions and with player welfare, 12 of those weeks, it's essential that the body recovers and it's rest periods. So you probably have 40 weeks, and with that, I think if you could get 30 really meaningful games, you'd have a really attractive calendar.
So 30 games is about the optimum for a player to be fully fit and all going well. You could play 30 games a year, could you?
You could. Yeah, you could. You could, yeah. 30, 80 minutes is probably a bit of an ask. But I think when I was firing, I really thought the optimum was kind of 3 out of 4 Saturdays of the month. So, you know what I mean, if that's 9 months of the year, you're up around 27 games, and then you have a 12-week preseason.
And, like I think if that if everybody just agreed that that was what the story was, then the players aren't going to play all of their league matches, and so the owners of the clubs have to realise that they're so if you've got 30 games, 10 of those are going to be internationals, or 12 of those are going to be internationals, and the club have you for 18 games, and the compensation gets worked out between I will pay as the international team 50% of your salary to the clubs, and suddenly we're beginning to look like if there's a deal doable at least.
Yeah, but I think then there's it's the devil is in the detail. It's the nitty gritty. Take Toulouse for example, where a lot of their players play for France. Okay, and if there's a double header, if there's a top 14 and a French international on it that weekend, because if they're looking to increase the amount of games that the national team are playing, the president of Toulouse isn't going to be very happy with that because of the fact that he wants his players playing for Toulouse to give that his team the best chance of winning. So already, you know, I mean, they're not happy. So
what's the hierarchy? Exactly. Yeah, and that's and you need to work that out, and they need to be compensated somehow because there's more money in the game from TV deals or whatever. And here's the thing: there's going to be less money. There's going to be less money for clubs for people coming through the doors, and there's going to be less money for TV deals as we look on the other side of this, and there's going to be less money from sponsorship too. So I think all of a sudden everything is on the table and everything is up for grabs.
Well, like that, I think that is exactly the key point. And there's, you know, I think we're, 55 days in confinement. Today is the first day it's been lifted and there's a semblance of normality back around the place with, I suppose, a lot more volume of traffic on the streets over here this morning. But there's still 55 days that have passed. But where are we with the progress we've been, I suppose, attempting to make in the world game? I'm not too sure, because all of a sudden the big focus now, and there's enough of a focus on trying to keep clubs, I suppose, afloat with the financial implications and challenges. But as you rightly pointed out a number of minutes ago, if the people are serious about change, I think if you want to have realistic or improved change, a lot of work has to go into it to get the structures right, because this is the one chance when there has been a pause in any sporting calendar to get it right. So, but I suppose you're going to have to be united, and you have to adapt, and you're going to have to compromise to come up with potential solutions. But I think there is opportunities to get the calendar better.
Do you think these conversations are happening? Like, do you think the ownership groups of the top 14 clubs and the English clubs are actually having these types of conversations with the respective unions, or has everybody kind of become very entrenched over the last while? Understandably enough.
Definitely. I think there's a big meeting on Tuesday, which is tomorrow, yeah, between World Rugby and the French and the English League. So, you know, I think the big issue would be that the history involved in the top 14, they don't really like to move their calendar at all. So World Rugby are looking for example, in October, maybe Ireland playing France again, and are they going to play them a second time? And then all of a sudden, that's another weekend gone for players playing in the top 14. And what's going to happen around Six Nations time, and how many doubleheaders are you going to play at Six Nations time? But that can be, I think, as you said, compromise can be easily reached there. Really, really important, I think, that you have, I think, really bright people involved in creating a potentially better calendar.
Do you have any idea when you're all going to be allowed to go back to work and resume contact sessions and all that kind of stuff?
No, we've been, was kind of option A, B, C, D and E at this stage nearly. And we're, as a staff, we're kind of working on potential scenarios. And so much is obviously dictated by the health minister in France. But there is a date of September the 5th for the first round of the top 14. And where everyone is kind of working back from that. But there's kind of three stages before you even get to that, obviously. So phase one is kind of a questionnaire and more and testing. And then phase two is kind of like a 3-week period to get the body back to where it probably was before confinement, and then you may have a 7 to 10 week pre-season where you obviously just attack as best you can, and then hope you play two friendly games and back to matches on the 5th. But there are so many question marks still in the air over here about how it can possibly take place with social distancing, and obviously economically with the model of, if there aren't people coming to the ground, there are clubs like our club that it wouldn't be sustainable.
Ronan, were you in favour, just out of interest, at the time of abandoning the entire league? Because I think a lot of people have been mentioning over the last couple of weeks about how players and managers are left in limbo quite a bit at the moment, whereas there was a very definitive full stop put on sport in France.
Yeah, it was brutal. I was completely against it, in the fact that I was hoping, I understand why it was abandoned, that's it, but like, your whole year is built on playing the knockout rugby, because I think as a coach you need that challenge, you need that competitive spirit tested, and even if you fail, I think you get great learnings and you get to taste it. Having worked from last July to now and not have that opportunity, it gnaws at you big time, and I think that was why it was so difficult, because there was great rumours at the time that maybe there might be just the teams in the top six now. So one plays, the first two go through and three plays six and four plays five. So we would have played for four teams. So, but like, you're essentially 160 minutes away from a final, which is a great position to be in, or a great mindset to have for you and your players when you're coming back. But that's been abandoned now, and I suppose it's a void year, as they call it. So, but like, if you're a sporting person and you're a competitor, you need finals footy. That's what you're judged on.
That's the whole reason for everything existing. Here, listen, you know, at least you did make the final and all the way up to the mount in Mount Rushmore, Cork Sporting Mount Rushmore. Of all the achievements in your career, Ronan, the thousands and thousands of points, the hundreds of caps, all those appearances, the brilliant coaching career, finally it's all distilled down to Cork Sporting Mount Rushmore. You made it, buddy.
I did. Jeez, that was big. It was some talent in Cork, isn't there? Wow. A few of the GA boys weren't happy, but it was, it was my sporting hero. I was contesting, I think, against Jimmy Barry Murphy. So once you're in that company, everything is good. There was obviously a few non-negotiables, and Sonia and Roy, obviously. And who else got there?
Christy Ring, I think.
Christy Ring, yes, of course. That's before my time, so I don't have appreciation, but you've always got to respect the past, don't you? There's always a past.
Standing on the shoulders of giants, I believe, is the phrase we're all reaching for.
but it's very, very special. Believe me, I think it becomes more special when you're on the coach, because I'm listening to the show every morning, and you know what I mean? You can say it's grand. It's not grand if you're not on it, though, because if something unfortunately inside me that's ultra competitive, and I need to be there, and that's my mindset, you know. And thankfully, you get there because of a bloody good team you played on as well. That's the most important thing, you know. I think there's so many situations where you can analyse a game if you're behind a beaten pack as well, you know. So a great, great honour. Meath is up this morning. Are the results out?
The results are not out. Tommy Rooney is standing by.
Yeah, I was chatting to Tommy. I gave Tommy my votes.
Who did you stick on?
I had three definites. I went Sean Boylan, Graham Geraghty and Trevor Giles. Trevor Giles was an amazing player. And then I was leaning to Colm O'Rourke, and then I got sent through video clippage of Mick Lyons. So I said, geez, I forgot about him. He was an animal. So he's straight in. But you have Barry Geraghty, you have Noel Mead, you have all the Horsey contingent.
Johnny Murta.
Johnny Murta. Oh, wow. Well, Johnny Murtha is a genius, yeah, I think, when it came to riding horses, yeah. So,
I might try and steal him for Kildare, though, if he doesn't make it on to Meath today. So.
And Shane Horgan, what county is Shane Horgan?
Shane Horgan's Meath. No ifs, ands, or buts, he's Meath, yeah.
He qualifies for a few counties, no?
He went to school in Louth, I think, but...
yeah, well, exactly, you know, so... yeah, well, Shaggy is definitely up there, yeah.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Look, when you were talking about competitiveness, you reminded me of Michael Jordan right there. I don't know if you've seen the documentary, if you're watching it, but...
Whoa, that's a compliment. No, I haven't, and...
You'll enjoy it.
It's on the list. I was so far behind in my own work, Jar, that I needed to... I kind of went podcast first, and I haven't got onto any visual stuff, so... I think for other people too, those leaders questions that yourself and Stuart did were brilliant as well. I think there's so many nuggets in them from people all around the world. That's a great, I suppose, it's a great tool for anyone involved in sport. I found those fascinating. Maybe I'm 18 months too late, am I?
No.
Was that 18 months ago, six months ago?
Yeah, that was 18 months. So we did two series of it. There's two seasons of it out. We must republish those at this time and maybe get another one, another few in the can.
Yeah, they're good. They're really good.
Right, well, on that note, thanks very much for all that.
Good man.
Plenty of food for thought. We'll talk to you again soon. Take care.
See you guys. Cheers. See you.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.